Hello and welcome to another episode of Finding Annie. We have such a good episode for you this week, but before looking forwards, let's look backwards. Cue rewind sound. Last week we had an episode that was all about working and parenting. Jessie Ware and I had an expletive ridden therapy session talking very honestly about how we try and do both work and parent at the same time. We got emails about it. Thank you so much for your emails. It's good to hear from you. I want to read out two today. Both are from Sarah's. So shout out to Sarah number one, who says the following. I asked for answers, by the way, on the eternal conundrum of working and parenting. So this is Sarah's answers. Parenting will always be riddled with guilt, but that's because we love our kids. So the guilt is actually love that feels like a punch in the stomach. Focus on the love bit and the guilt subsides. Okay. She also goes on to say, having a supportive, encouraging workplace who truly values the extra load we carry is something we all deserve. But if that's not there, we must be each other's cheerleaders. Water, women, huggers and believers. So thank you so much to Sarah 1. That's so, so true. And Sarah 2 says, I had a successful business but gave it up to be with my kids. I consider myself lucky to have been able to do that. I'm an intelligent, ambitious woman. And although some may think that I've sold myself short or not reached my true potential, that I have somehow let womankind down by not returning to work, by putting my family first, I am inferior. It is true that over the years, I have come across women that look down their nose at me. Tough to do as I'm 5'10". You know what? That's their problem, not mine. Thank you both for your intelligent input to the conversation. And yeah, real nice to be getting that from you. This week's episode is entitled The Fame Game. If you have anything to say about what you're about to hear, any opinions, any experiences with fame or famous people, I'd love to hear from you. Any anecdotes or opinions, get them in to findingannymac@gmail.com. And we will start this episode with a memory. Actually, just FYI, this is the memory that triggered me doing this entire podcast. This is the memory that freaked me out so much. That I was like, I'm losing my memory and I've got to try and get my friends and family to help me claw my life back because I'm forgetting really important things. So yeah, this is the original one. This is Grimmy and I discussing a very special day a good few years ago.
Okay, so every Sunday you'd come and collect me from home.
Why, by the way? Because I lived so far away from you.
It was kind of
into having a car, wasn't it?
You were into having a car, and a car in London, I think, is a novelty.
Yeah.
Like, I was really like, Annie has a car. sitting in the front of a car in London is mad.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
You're not in a taxi or on a bus.
Yeah.
And you'd pick me up every Sunday. I guess no traffic. It's an easy drive.
Yeah.
And then we'd always go in, and I can't believe that we'd always get into work for like 5 to 7 mm-hmm. when our show was at 7. Mm-hmm. No prep.
Why can't we do that anymore?
I don't know. One day I was at Kate's house for like a barbecue or Sunday roast or something. Mm-hmm. And
it was summertime.
It was summertime, so maybe it was a barbecue. Mm-hmm. And you were going to come and pick me up from there.
But you just gave me the postcode.
Yeah.
Just FYI. So I just got like rocked up to this mansion in Highgate and was like, where am I? And then it was like Kate Moss's house. Great. Cheers for the
heads up. Otherwise, you would have come in a high fashion look. And I can't remember what happened now, but oh yeah, so she'd just moved in there, and her neighbour, like a few doors down, was George Michael. Mm. And I think the only person that she's like super nervous around and like, oh my god, it's them, is George Michael. And I was like, he's on the balcony. And everyone in the garden was like, of course he is. And I was like, George, come over. And everyone was like, of course he is, because they didn't believe that he was, but he actually was. Mm. And then he came round to the house and sort of invited himself in, and then it was all of a sudden really weird because George Michael was there and no one knew him, and it was weird. And then you knocked at the door.
Yeah.
And I don't think I got the door.
No, I didn't.
Did George Michael get the door?
No, I think Kate Moss got the door.
And you were like, hello. And then
I remember Anita Pallenberg was there.
Yeah, Anita Pallenberg was there. Mm-hmm. And you came into the garden, say hi to everybody. Mm-hmm. And when you came in, George Michael saw you and was like, oh my god, it's Annie Mac.
No, he did
yes,
not.
Yes, he did. Like, he didn't freak out, but he was like, oh, Annie Mac's here. Like, he knew who Annie Mac was. And he's like a massive house music, dance music fan. So he used to listen to your show. Is this what materialized through the conversation? And he basically was telling everyone how much he loves your show. And then he began to play you music that he'd made. Like, he'd made, like, new, like, dance music or, like, electronic music. And he was saying that he was going to do a project which was all done by gay people. And he was going to have, like, him singing it and gay producers and gay engineers and gay music video directors. Well, that was his idea at the time. Mm. And he played it, but I can't remember what the song sounded like. And I can't remember what the outcome was, because I think we'd had some wine. And then we went to work.
I can't remember it. So I can remember flashbacks. I can remember people sat in the garden. I don't remember. I have a memory of him sitting near me. I can't put George Michael in that memory. I can't put him in. I'm just like, why the fuck does my brain not compute? It doesn't
remember. I don't know, because I can remember it happening, but now I'm telling it back, it sounds like I'm lying.
So absurd.
Doesn't it?
Was he wearing a bathrobe?
He was wearing a bathrobe and, like, George Michael sunglasses.
So
maybe he looked so much like George Michael, we couldn't take it in.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like when kids meet, like, Barney the dinosaur summer.
And they're just
too
like,
oh, it's too weird.
Their brain explodes.
Yeah.
I had been blinded by fame, blinded by the light of George Michael. And Grimmie said, maybe it's like just inexplicable. Like, maybe it's like looking at a waterfall. You can't stop staring at it, or looking at a flame. You know, why do your eyes be drawn to a flame like that? So, yeah, some people are just incredibly, overwhelmingly dazzling. And George Michael was one of those people for me. The cult of celebrity is something I was definitely initially drawn to when I moved to the big smoke, London town. I wanted to be successful, and I also very much wanted to be famous. I wanted the fame and the success. I was curious about the fame. As I've got older and experienced a very low level of fame, I have become more and more repelled by it. I guess having seen glimpses of extreme fame over the years, like, you know, paparazzi and the reality of what paparazzi looks like and sounds like, the kind of physical threatening presence of it, it's not nice. It's not something I would wish upon anyone. I've had two, I guess, separate experiences of fame, in that DJing has afforded me a kind of intense level sometimes of fame, and that would mainly be when you're in a room and you are the kind of main attraction and everyone is staring at you and everyone wants to be your friend and everyone's shouting in your face and that kind of thing. So that's kind of, you know, any other DJ can relate to that, when you're really kind of in the centre of attention. And that is something that I kind of deal with by boozing, or just kind of a loud internal dialogue that switches on and off quite quickly. And then the other level is much more gentle, and that is radio. I'm so comfortable and happy in the level of, I guess you'd call it, fame that radio brings, because it's warm. You know, people don't see you, they only hear you. So they're hearing your personality. There's a kind of real familiarity with people when they meet me because of radio. So if I'm out and people have listened to my show all their lives, or you know, for years, they will feel like they know me so well, because I've been speaking to them personally, you know, one to one, for all this time, in their house, in their car. I've been with them. So there's this element of real companionship there. And that's a nice thing, I think. And I'm happy to be in that situation where, you know, people don't like run across the street and go, ah, can I favorite picture. It's more just like they'll sidle up to you in boots and be like, I love your show, it's great, oh god, love it, dance every Friday. And that's like brilliant. Okay, so I'm very lucky in that the main part of my job affords me a very kind of warm and gentle side of fame. It is something I wanted to discuss, though, because one of the reasons why I'm grateful for the way that my career planned out is because I had a chance to be a fucking idiot. I had a chance to make loads of mistakes. I had a chance to dress terribly. I had a chance to look terrible. I did it all away from any sort of camera or away from any sort of social media, which I'm so fucking grateful for. And I only became remotely in the public eye from my kind of mid to late 20s. So I'm glad about that. And our guest today is similar in that way, that she only really found fame in her 30s. She was always the person I wanted to speak to with regards to fame and the absurdity of fame, because she's been exposed to lots of different types of fame, be it kind of working with huge movie stars to huge TV stars, doing the Hollywood thing, doing the kind of Emmys, doing the BAFTAs, all of that. And also that kind of familiarity fame that's similar to radio, in that she does comedy and she does it really well. And people kind of are very warm about that kind of side of things. We're going to meet her now. Her name is Sharon Horgan. She is an indomitable force of television. She's a really gifted screenwriter. She is a comedian. She is an actress. She does all three really well, as well as being a parent. And she's someone who I've admired from afar for a very, very long time. And I was well excited to go to see her in her house and sit down and have it out about her journey to fame and her relationship with it. So yeah, welcome to the podcast, Sharon Horgan. Can we start by you telling me about when you left Ireland for England?
Oh, wow.
What was in your head about, like, going to make it?
Okay, but you have to tell me.
100%.
Okay. So I left Ireland for England in 1989. And I had done an almost year at art college in Dublin. And, you know, I was kind of part of a nicer scene there and had some great friends. But I realized art college definitely wasn't for me. And it literally was, I'm going to go to London and make my fortune. I'd applied for, I sort of, you know, wanted to do the acting thing. And I'd applied for some, you know, degree courses like theatre studies at Trinity and that, and didn't get in. And so I was a bit like, you know, I was like, well, now I'm all out of ideas. And so I thought, well, I'll just go to London and just take a chance. And I don't even know what my plan was. I didn't really have one. Yeah. I had some friends over there, like not even that many. And yeah, so I just packed my bags and left. And I think the third day I was there, I got knocked down by a motorcycle.
And, why are you laughing at this? I should be laughing. That's traumatic.
It was really traumatic. Yeah. And
were you hurt bad?
I mean, my leg just sort of was like a balloon. It was so swollen. But I was so embarrassed at having been knocked down. I remember like crawling across the road, just trying to pick up all my shit. And then crawled back to the squat I was staying in. And then when I got back, the guy who we were staying with kind of went, ah, your leg's fucked. And so then, like, going to the hospital.
He told you.
Like, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And did you think about going home then?
I thought about going home all the time. Yeah. But it kind of got to that point where, you know, a couple of years went by and, like, nothing was happening. I had this job at the job centre and, you know, I was, like, sort of doing bits of courses, like, you know, drama courses in the evenings or anything I could find, but wasn't really doing anything. And I was just too sort of embarrassed at my terrible situation to go home. I thought, well, I'll just wait until my chair. I thought I'll just wait until, you know, something comes up. But yeah, I think I just thought someone was gonna tap me on the shoulder and say, oh my God, you are come with me.
Clearly you are talented and beautiful. Get on that screen.
Honestly.
Yeah.
And then I think I continued to think that for a while until I stopped thinking it. And then it was more sort of like, oh, it's never going to happen. I'll have to find something else to do. Mm.
When did you start actually writing? Like you were writing all the way through your 20s?
No, not really. I was sort of, you know, putting on plays above pubs and that kind of thing. I was doing kind of doing the fringe theatre thing, and I didn't really start writing. Yeah, I suppose I started writing sort of mid-20s, that kind of thing, and not in a concentrated way, just sort of like here and there. And then I started taking it a bit more seriously when I met Dennis Kelly, and he had written a play, and, you know, I thought it was very good, even though now he would say it was really not very good. But I was like, oh God, this is, this has got characters and there's a story and people go in and out of doors and it is a play. And so then me and him just started writing together. That was how I kind of started doing it. Not necessarily properly, but in a way where I was like, you know, I would sit down and go, this is what we're doing now. And we would meet, you know, a few days a week and sit down and sort of start writing sort of comedy. We started writing comedy sketches and we started writing pilots for things that were never made, obviously. But, you know, we were like, this is our sort of job.
And then tell me about the kind of inception of Pulling in your head. When did that?
We sort of thought, well, let's write about what we know, obviously, and that was our, you know, misspent 20s and our lives living in shared accommodation, working in unsatisfactory jobs, messing up relationships, and generally kind of failing, I suppose. And we love the idea of writing it through the eyes of these three women, myself in particular, because I just really wasn't getting anything sort of interesting to play myself, you know. And we wrote a pilot script and they commissioned the series off of the pilot script. We didn't even have to
make the pilot.
No.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a really good script, though. Like, we spent a long time on it. I mean, we did spend a long time writing it, but...
And were you always wanting to play one of the girls? Was that in your voice?
Yeah.
You wanted to find a role that was real.
Yeah,
but
also it was pure, like, you know...
Yeah,
Chancer, though, thing to do. I mean, no one had offered me the lead in anything except myself. So I was like, yes, I'll do that.
And how was it going from then being like virtually, you know, unknown in the world in terms of like on a level of fame to then starring in a sitcom on Channel 4? That must have been quite a jump.
Well, it was on BBC Three, so not that many people saw it.
All right.
You know, it wasn't that much of a jump. I'd sort of done, you know, a series on Channel 4, and I'd done like the Friday Night Project, the first series of that. And I'd done, I just started doing Annually Retentive with Rob Brydon, which I think way more people saw that.
Okay.
And, but in terms of like having success that felt, you know, like I'd something to do with it, that was the big sort of difference, I think. But like fame wise, I mean, it just definitely, It's weird. I think maybe in the first while it's on, people might come up and say, I like your show. As soon as it's over, like, people just forget that you've done that thing. So then it just goes. So you're brought back to earth so quickly. I mean, you get kind of 6 weeks of it.
Yeah.
And then it would just sort of depend on like what the demographic was. So, you know, if I went to Knightsbridge, for example, I mean, no one would give me a second look. If I went to Glastonbury or, you know, something or some sort of market in Hackney or whatever, you know, then people would come up to you. But it was always like very, very low key, low level.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And so after Pulling came out, and as you were saying, it was the idea of you being behind it. Did you feel like that opened shitload of doors for you in terms of writing more, getting more opportunities to produce?
Yeah. I mean, definitely. But again, it's not that easy, you know. I kind of only started realizing how hard it was after Pulling, actually, because again, it's sort of like, what is your next thing gonna be that feels as right for you and feels as sort of its time, I suppose, and sort of that fits in with everything else that's on you know, on the air. Mm. And so it just took a long time for me to figure out what that next thing was.
I mean, it's from the outside. I think it obviously you just can't see or understand the slog that goes into actually creating TV,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And the pilots and the amount of...
Yeah.
Like, how long does something take? Let's say, I mean, you've done it from the early stages of an idea to actually watching it on telly. I know there's no fixed thing, but roughly, like...
Yeah, there is no fixed thing. If it's the route of... You pitch an idea, you get a treatment commissioned, you write the treatment, you get a pilot script commissioned, you write the pilot, you get your pilot commissioned, you make the pilot, you get your series commissioned, you write the series, you make the series, you edit the series goes out. I mean, that if it's that sort of route, I mean...
Like, which is a standard route, it sounds
which,
like.
Which is a standard route if you're lucky, because oftentimes, you know, you fall at any of those hurdles I've just sort of mentioned along the way. Yeah. But I mean, it's got to be like, it can be 3 years, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
It can be less.
Yeah.
It can be 2 years.
Yeah.
But it's from idea to telly is a chunk of time.
Looking back now, are you happy that you had that time in your 20s? That was a kind of no man's land of figuring stuff out. Or are you? Do you wish that it all happened when you were like 21?
I sort of do.
Because I resent going to university. I'm like, I fucking didn't need to do that. I wish I'd just gone straight to radio when I was like 19.
Yeah.
And everything. I'd be like 5 years ahead of myself right now.
Yeah. I don't know. I suppose I'm a bit sad that I didn't have the confidence, I think, to sort of push myself to make it happen sooner. Because I, thinking about it now, I know that that's what it was, you know. And also, you know, the fear of failure or being told no and that kind of thing. But it's literally pointless, wasted energy regretting anything. But at the same time, I think when you get older, you do sort of think, did I use time wisely? And I mean, I could sort of say the same about myself at the moment, certainly the last couple of months.
Are you mad? Like,
I'm not using my time that wisely, but that's okay. That's okay. But yeah, no, I do. I mean, for years, my off-pat sort of answer was, well, you know, I don't regret that because if I hadn't, you know, wasted, about the place for 10 years, I wouldn't have been able to write that show, which was, you know, which is still one of the loves of my life. And, and getting to work with Dennis and all of that. But, you know, I could have done it in 2 to 3 years, the wasting period. I didn't have to go the full decade. It's just that thing, isn't it? Like if you could give yourself, your younger self, a talking to, it's more sort of that. Because I do sort of get slightly jealous of people who have that extra gene or whatever it is to push themselves and to be so ambitious at a younger age. Like to have that sort of confidence at a younger age is, I get jealous of it. I'm like, wow, you are built for this industry, you know? Whereas I don't necessarily think I was built for this industry. I think I sort of became capable over lots of years and only after I had a certain amount of projects under my belt, and even then not so much because I would always sort of collaborate with people. It was always very easy to think, oh, you know, the success is because of them, or you know, the quality of the work is because of them, and never sort of let myself, you know, just enjoy the fact that I might be quite good at something, you know.
And do you find that because you were, I mean, what age were you when Pulling became,
I wasn't,
thing. Obviously,
I wasn't,
you were
that,
on the telly
young,
already,
yeah.
As you said.
So it was, by the time it went out, it was 2006. So I was like 36.
Yeah.
You know.
But do you think maybe that was a good thing as well,
though? Oh, it was definitely a good thing in terms of like my personality.
Yeah.
You know,
you were fully, wholly yourself.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. And also, I was so grateful. I was so fucking grateful. Okay. And, you know, like I found the whole thing just wonderful, you know, like, turning up on set and seeing, you know, people there for something you know, myself and my friend had written, and, you know, just the idea of like someone collecting me in a car to take me somewhere to go and do this thing, or, you know, I found a lot of joy in it, but, which is good. And I think it stopped, I think there's a chance if, you know, success or fame comes to you when you're younger, there's a really high percentage of you turning into an asshole. And not that I haven't been an asshole in my life, you know, I have for sure, but definitely less of a one, I think, if it had sort of got handed to me on a plate early doors. And, you know, I think if you really have to work for something, you appreciate it a lot more.
Do you see it? Do you see it happening?
What?
People turning into arseholes.
I mean, yeah, of course.
It's mad with the radio show because you see people in the really early stages.
Oh, yeah.
Coming in all kind of wide-eyed and grateful. And, and then, like, it's just mad seeing them, like, every 6 months or whatever for the next few years. And you're like, you've changed.
Yeah, I mean, it can
happen. Like, they've got shades on. You're like, hang on a second.
It can happen on the turn of a dime, you know.
It's mad, isn't it?
Which makes it hilarious.
When you can see it, you know, perspective on it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good thing, I guess, about like achieving success later in life, is because you have perspective on it. You know what it's like to be fucking, to not have to get the bus to work and not.
Well, that's it. But it also, you know, it does make you a little cynical. Like, you do sort of, and also having been in business for a while and sort of been on the receiving end of, you know, reactions, sort of good and bad, and how quickly people sort of, you know, flip their opinion, and how I guess you can just sort of, it's not like seeing through it. It's not, I mean, there's worse industries, the arms industry, for example, but it is a fickle world. And I think just sort of being able to sort of separate yourself, just take a step back and look at it. And I think really, like, a good number of years ago, I was able to sort of look at it and go, like, what exactly am I aiming for? Like, what am I hoping to achieve? Like, what's the end goal? And to reach some kind of level of success where just to stay there is gonna, like, you know, almost destroy you, or you know, or to keep hustling to get to the very tippity top, and then what? Like, you fall. I mean, most people do. I mean, there's just this tiny handful of people who are sort of able to stay there, and then you kind of think, at what cost? And so I think sort of years ago, I kind of worked out, well, it really just has to be about what you want to make and what you'd like to watch. And really, if things come up that look like they'd be fun, do them.
How have you navigated the more kind of fickle side of the whole game? Like, in terms of having to do red carpets, having to go to snazzy parties and all that business.
I don't do any of it.
You don't?
I don't go to any of it. I don't do any of it.
And did you find that hard at the start? Did you feel the pressure where people are like, well, you fucking have to do this because it's your show?
No, because I've never had that sort of level of fame. I just haven't. I mean, if I'd really pushed it and looked to you know, get PR very early and made sure I was at those things, or, like, you know, went on as many sort of TV shows as possible. And I mean, I did a few sort of in the early days, and then I realized I'd felt uncomfortable and, you know, stressed. And I was like, well, maybe it's just enough that I do what I do. Like, maybe that's enough. I go to things if, like, say, if a show I'm doing has been nominated or something, or if I've been in the film that is premiering, I'll go to that. But, you know, I still feel uncomfortable and hope it is over as possible. But apart from that, no. I don't. Sorry, I'm just eating a grape now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What about you working with people who have reached these insane levels of fame. So I read about Carrie Fisher calling herself, in your article that you wrote for The Guardian, Mickey Mouse, which I thought was so interesting, the idea of owning people, people feeling like they have an ownership over you because they've watched you a certain amount of times. How was it with her initially, kind of being in the same room as her, with her being that overwhelmingly famous?
Well, I mean, the thing I think with some people who have that overwhelming sort of level of fame, they go from cars to, you know, members clubs to restaurants where not many, you know, regular people go to, you know, someone covering them with an umbrella into the next car, into the next, you know, covered area. I mean, I'm not saying that Carrie wasn't able to just sort of, you know, hang out and do her own thing. But when I was with her, it was always in sort of very sort of, you know, closed off kind of areas. And some people seem to be able to walk around invisible, people who've got high levels of fame, and some people just aren't. And I mean, even like I was doing an interview with Anna Maxwell Martin the other day, who plays Julia in Motherland. And because I think she was saying, she could be right, because it's a comedy, people feel even like they know you even more, almost like, I mean, not quite soap level, but you know, soap, everyone thinks they know you. Sitcom, they're quite familiar with you. Drama, they're like, they leave you alone. So like she was saying that you know, people kind of grab her, like they want to sort of touch her and stuff, and it, only in a sort of excited kind of, you know, can I talk to you about, I love that character kind of thing. But you know, I think other people who have got in, you know, a higher level of fame can sort of pass by unnoticed. It's all very weird. I mean, even on like my level, which is pretty low level, it's a strange thing because you like it. I mean, you like people coming up to you and telling you they like what you do, because that is, you know, I'm lucky in that. That's always, I've never had anyone come up and, you know, throw anything at me or tell me, try and take me down. It's always just been lovely. And like 90% of the time it's women. And it's 90% of that time it's women kind of my age. And a lot of them are Irish. And I did this, I forget what it was, but some kind of talk in Ireland, I can't remember who it was, got me over, but the majority of the audience were Irish women of my age. And I've never, I mean, it was just nuts. I mean, that kind of thing would affect your ego. But, because so they're just really nice to me. And, and it's kind of, I can see it being kind of addictive a little bit, because if you're having a bad day, you know, and if you are feeling down about yourself, or if you're, you know, the thing you're writing isn't coming together, or you've had, you know, something rejected, or it's a weird boost. So that's problematic, I think. Because that's not always going to be there. And I think the thing is just to really, really try to not rely on that, you know. But for people who have enormous level of fame, I mean, that must be, I can't even get my head around that the sort of, you know, serotonin levels and all that kind of thing. And, you know, what happens when, I used to think about my brother, you know, who played rugby internationally, and, you know, it would be the crowd sort of, you know, the swell of that crowd sort of screaming when, you know, he'd score a try or, you know, anything. And then like the buzz of that, and just, you know, you're doing it for your country, and like you are a national hero. And then what happens, you know, in bed that night when you're sort of coming down off that, or when you get up the next morning, and what happens when that career kind of ends? Like, where do you get those sort of levels of, you know, I guess they're sort of joy, aren't they? And I mean, any sensible person would tell you to just put no stock in it, but how can you not? It's sort of it's there, and you like it.
You cannot feel it. You cannot feel it. With directing, how's that been?
It's been great. Yeah. I mean, ask any woman who's directed anything for the first time. They're suddenly like, oh, great, I have the power.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. You're never getting this back. And like, so that's what happened to me when I directed my first thing, which was years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember going, all right, this is what I'm doing now. And then realized it wasn't really enough money. But also realizing that once you stop, because I had to really force myself to do it,
yeah.
You know, because I didn't have the confidence. But once you step away from it for long enough, you kind of lose the confidence again. And,
yeah.
And you know, it's like anything. If you put yourself out there, you look back 6 months later and you go, how did I, was that a different person doing that?
How did I do that? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I kind of had that sort of thing. But I really enjoy it. I mean, it's stressful in that, I mean, even if you're writing and producing things, you have people who, you know, have to make sort of the final decision, I suppose, on things, which is kind of what the director does. So even though if you're a very hands-on writer producer, you still, there's plenty of people to sort of turn to and go, is this right? What do you think? And I think with the directing, the thing I had to get my head around was that there was no one.
You were the final.
It's like you were the final. Yeah, I was the last person in that line.
Yeah. And that's a confidence thing as well, isn't it? When you used to collaborate.
Completely.
It's like, okay, it stops with me.
Completely. I mean, the only thing I'll say is like you bring enough people in whose work is great and who you respect and admire, then it is still a collaboration because everyone always, you know, their sort of area of expertise is not necessarily going to be yours. I think what it comes down to with directing is I found was like, it was mostly with my taste, I suppose, like what I thought was the best shot or what I thought was the best, you know, route for that particular scene or, you know.
So there's no right or wrong as such. It's
that's
just
kind
personal.
Of thing. Yeah. So it's just trusting your taste.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I do enjoy it. It's a lot of work. It's all.
Yeah. I love when I came in, you were like, I don't have anything that's going on in my head. And you felt a bit like panicky. Because you're like, I need something to be got. Like I need a project, a creative project.
Yeah.
So are you one of those people that does panic when there's nothing going on? But you have, don't you have about 14 things going on? But they're different things.
They are different things. I mean, and I love that. It's an absolute joy working on other people's stuff. And it's another skill set, you know, which I'm developing, you know, is being able to look at someone else's thing and not sort of push my sort of vision for it on it, but just sort of take what's there and just help them sort of hone it or help it become the best it can be.
So was this way up a good example of that, of you kind of doing that?
Oh yeah, I mean, Aisling was, you know, she knew exactly what she wanted to do. She'd such a strong vision and idea and voice and you know, no one would tell Aisling what to do, but I think what I was able to do was give her my opinion on stuff which she, you know, appreciated. Because we've known each other for years and because she trust me and I think for newer writers, usually in general, they need a bit of sort of guiding and everyone needs a sort of pair of eyes that are slightly, you know, removed from a project to sort of come in and say what they think, because sometimes you get so sort of, you know, can't see the wood for the trees kind of thing. But I think what I was saying to you earlier was just, you know, post-catastrophe, it was the same as post-pulling. I loved that show so much and I loved writing it so much and I loved working with Rob so much and I really enjoyed playing that character and I really enjoyed, once we were in the middle of the scripts, kind of just diving in there and just being in that world and it's a weird sort of comfort, you know.
And it was a massive part of your life. For how many years?
Huge, like 5 years, you know, and always doing this thing. I mean, not that it was the only thing, but it was a huge part of every year. And so now I just, you know, in terms of coming up with the next thing that I want to do, which is for me, that's the thing that I think I haven't sort of nailed yet. And I'm telling myself that's okay, because at the moment I just have pages of things that are, you know, ideas or, you know, anything that sort of comes to me or you know, anything that I'm inspired by, I'm just sort of writing stuff down and sort of watching and listening, really.
Mm.
But, you know, I haven't quite got there. Mm. So, but that's, I mean, you have to take that time to find that thing, because you are going to have to live with it in success for a long time. But, you know, and there's been other times when I have the next idea ready to go. Like, you know, I finish one project and the next idea is ready to go. And when that happens, that's great.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And are you good at this bit, waiting around?
No.
Yeah.
No, I'm really not. I just, you know, I mean, I'm very impractical in a lot of ways, but just very practical in that I'm like, you know, I just sort of need to know what the next thing is. I need to know where, you know, where the next buck is coming from. You know, I mean, it's just, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
And we have loads of projects and loads of shows and loads of good stuff happening. But for me, it's just a personal thing. I need to know what my thing is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So.
Before we go, let's talk quickly about social media, because did you come off or something for a bit? I thought you said a thing where you're like, I'm out of here for a while.
I didn't say that actually, but
my bad.
Because I always hate when people go,
I'm
guys,
coming off.
I know you all really care.
You did a post where you're like, I haven't been on here for a while.
Yeah,
is that
I posted something on Instagram, because like I definitely use it as a marketing tool, and I don't know how successful it is, but when shows come out, I want people to sort of know about them. And I think it was when Aisling's show was coming out, and I I went back into Twitter just to have a little look, and I saw what an enormous reaction people were having to it. And so I posted something on Instagram that linked to Twitter, and then I thought, well, I feel really bad, because, you know, people talk to you on Twitter. And then, I mean, like we missed each other a few times. I hadn't been on there for so many months. Yeah. And I thought, well, I've obviously ignored a lot of people for a long time. Mm. I thought, well, I'll just say I haven't been on here.
Yeah.
It's just a needy kind of like, you know, overthinking thing. But I got off it because I was just, going down too many, you know, whatever the saying is. Wormholes.
Yeah.
With it. I genuinely was just lying there at night reading it and scrolling and going from one to the next to the next. And, you know, I was also getting caught up in sort of listening to people's arguments, you know. Mm. And oftentimes it would be, you know, someone I obviously followed, so, you know, admired in some way or another, getting sort of hounded by, you know, 5,000 people
raging.
And then what happened was people I, you know, followed and admired were arguing with other people I followed and admired, and when that started happening, actually I think it was around about the sort of Danny Baker sort of, you know, that time, I just think this is not healthy, and I spend too much time on it. And also I was spending so long kind of wording things, like even if it was just like, I'm gonna say something really off the cuff, I was like, oh shit, better not. Who do I really not want to offend versus who do I, it doesn't really matter. And so, yeah, whereas Instagram, hugely problematic on so many levels.
Why so?
Because, well, I have a 15-year-old daughter who you know, follows influencers and, you know, I guess people who are in the public eye and who project images of themselves that are perfect and unobtainable and also not real. And also, you know, that sense of, you know, the sort of missing the party kind of thing. Like if she goes on there and friends have sort of, you know, we're doing this thing over here.
You haven't been invited.
Yeah.
And you didn't know about it.
But generally it's just that sort of image of perfection, which is a lie. And I think for younger girls, it's just really destructive, but also horribly hard to avoid. And over the years, I've kind of taken her off it. But, you know, it's a tricky thing. And then also I find myself annoyed by it because we all put out this best version of ourselves. And whether it's, you know, someone wishing their husband or wife happy birthday and, you know, doing this big sort of like, you know, you are the greatest father, the greatest husband, the greatest man, and showing these snapshots. God, I really feel like I'm going off on one.
Like,
there,
rather than the fucking toilet seat yeah, they pissed on that
like
morning.
Like showing, you know, the moment where you plucked a beautiful flower with your beautiful young child, yeah. Not the screaming asshole child who, you know, 5 minutes before or after would have been there. And I think I have to constantly sort of slap myself and go, that's not real. That's not how it is.
Yeah.
How it is, you know, it's hard. It's hard for everyone. Maybe some people deal with it better than others. But overall, the whole thing is a fucking shit show. And that's what life is. And you know, I mean, in some ways, I am a little bit part of the problem in that, you know, I post about my shows. And so therefore, everything must be going great. Mm. But I mean, I do occasionally sort of get on there and say it's not happening today.
Mm.
But you know, even that feels indulgent. The whole thing is indulgent. But yeah. Anyway, one down. Yeah. The other ones will probably go at some point. So
how do you navigate that with your daughters as well in terms of like being in the public eye? Do they feel weird about that? Are they like teenagers?
Are they
embarrassed?
They have the same reaction as I have, really.
Yeah.
When people are absolutely lovely,
yeah,
there's no harm in it. I mean, I used to say to people that I wouldn't do pictures when I'm with my kids, which just seems to me like
obvious,
completely normal that thing.
Why would anyone
but
ask?
They found me so, my kids told me I was so rude. They were like, yeah, why would you say that to that nice woman who just, and I was like, well, it's, I guess it's
they
just,
they grew up in a generation where that's totally normalized.
Yeah,
they?
Yeah.
Whereas,
so, yeah. So actually, sometimes when I'm with them, I do it because they give me such a hard time.
Yeah.
But you know, equally, if someone's a bit sort of pawy and, you know, getting in my grill too much, then they find that awful.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it rarely happens, but you know, if someone is just being too much,
yeah,
they find it embarrassing and aggravating, which it is.
Mm.
But in general, people are lovely and so they find that lovely.
And it's nice.
Yeah.
They're proud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I always think with social media, remember that film with Jim Carrey, Liar Liar? When it was a film where you had to tell the truth, basically.
Okay, I didn't see it.
They should do that on social media. Like, it has to be like, you have to tell the truth just for a day.
Yeah.
Tell the truth today.
Yeah.
Because it would be so healthy for people, right?
Yeah.
It's just mad.
Yeah.
Okay, Sharon Horgan, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Really appreciate your time.
It's so nice to meet you.
And you.
Thank you so much to Sharon Horgan for that rather wonderful conversation. I loved talking to her. I thought she was really generous with her time, and I can't wait to see and experience what her next creative project ends up being. Okay, folks, next week on Finding Annie, we have a really interesting episode. It's going to be all about femininity. And the interview is with one of the world's most famous transsexuals, a lady called Amanda Lepore, who is a muse, a artist, a dancer, a model, and really quite something. Check this out.
I mean, I don't think that he's good. I mean, there's more and more shocking things that you hear just from Instagram, you know, like the, like, one of them that was really sad was a trans girl, like, that was a sex change in the army.
Mm.
And she had her surgery when she was in the army, and she had to fix complications, and the government was paying for the surgery. Mm. And then when Trump went on, he denied her. And she got fired, too.
Wow.
For, like, the military thing. So, really fucked up her life. And she's, like, a sweet, beautiful girl.
Mm.
You know?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, he's not good for, you know, alternative people, you know, good people. So, like, I don't know. And they both have really bad hair. I mean, I can't get over
it. Donald needs Lorenzo in his life.
Yes, I think that the wife, I don't know her name, but...
Melania? Is it
the wigs are really bad. Really, really, really bad. And you could tell that a gay guy does not do them. Or if he does, I don't know what's going on, but they're really bad. Like a gag when I see it.
We'll see you next week. Bye.